We worked it out. Other, any questions? Great.
Let's thank our
So Jorah is going to give us a talk about tangles, wheels, and balloons.
So first of all, I hope you're not horrified by the video. I try to put every talk I give on my website so that I can refer people to them later. And in fact, it would be wonderful if everybody did that, right? Because, you know, sometimes you hear something wise and you want to hear it again and it's not there. And secondly, my talk will follow a handout. If you don't have a copy, there are a few more over here. Okay. And so I will describe a computable non-commutative invariant. So the two words in green here were added to the abstract and are not in the official abstract. So I have to tell you what I mean by that. Well, anyway, it's an invariant of tangles with values in wheels. It almost generalizes to something two-dimensional, maybe related to quantum field theory. All of this will come later, but I first want to tell you a bit about computable and non-commutative. So first of all, what do I mean by non-commutative? I mean it takes values in some space which is sort of non-commutative. And what non-commutative means, well, let me explain. So for example, the free associative and non-commutative algebra on a number of generators is an example for a non-commutative space, okay? And the good news about it is that if you look, for example, at the free associative algebra in two generators in dimension D, then the dimension is roughly 2 to the D. In fact, I think it's precisely 2 to the D. And on the other hand, if you look at the commutative algebra on two generators in dimension D, the dimension is roughly D, okay, which is a lot less. So if you have an invariant with values in something non-commutative, it is potentially way stronger. So that's one reason why I'm happy, and or why I've added it to the abstract. And the other is, okay, and the other thing I've added to the abstract is computable. So why do I like computable? So one answer is, more and more I think it's because I'm weird, because other people seem not to like computable. In fact, people seem to be deterred by things once somebody can actually program them. So I'm weird. What can I do? I actually don't believe my own result until my own theorems. You know, if I prove that side 1 of Rademeister 1 is equal to side 2 of Rademeister 1, I don't believe it until I've actually run a program that checks it. Okay, so, but also I just like the results when you can actually print them out in detail. So note, though, that when I say computable, things like the fundamental group is not computable. So the fundamental group of the complement of a knot, well, there is an easily written presentation, but it doesn't make it computable because in practice, given two such presentations, you have no idea if they're the same or not. So in some sense, the fundamental group of a knot is far from a computable invariant. Okay? So when I say computable, I really mean practically computable. So the invariant I'm about to tell you about, when evaluated on the Borromean tangle written here, to degree 5, you get, you know, 1 over 6 times 3 times this wheel plus 2 times this wheel. It really is computable. And two things are the same, or, you know, and it's very hard, easy to tell if two such combinations are the same or not. Okay, it's just a straightforward comparison. Okay. Mostly, I'm going to tell you about how to define this invariant and what it does within ordinary knot theory. And I kind of already know that I will not have the time that I need to tell you about the second half of the handout. So I'll start with it. So my main question is, to what extent does the invariant extend to balloons? So balloons are two knots, right? You see these are spheres. So there are two knots embedded into R4, and what I really mean is balloons that are connected by strings, attached by strings to a common base point. So I really am looking at embeddings of this picture into R4. And I have good reasons to believe that the invariant mostly extends to such things, and strong evidence to suggest that, but I will only partially be able to tell you about it. And that's my big question, does it extend? And part of the reason why I believe it extends is that there is quantum field theory evidence that it extends. So again, I will not be able to tell you about the quantum field theory evidence, but I will be able to, so therefore I'm telling you about it right now. There is a certain quantum field theory, the so-called BF theory, which is supposed to make sense on precisely these creatures and give invariants with precisely the right space, inside precisely the right space, but there are issues, as always, with interpreting it. So signs don't quite work out, and maybe I get only half of what I get in the combinatorial three-dimensional case. There may be more integrals than I need, and I don't know what to say about them. And in general, I don't quite know how to reduce this quantum field theoretic invariant to combinatorics and algebra. Therefore, I don't know how to compute it. Therefore, it goes against my own ideology. Okay. Anyway, let me start with the, so let me go back to the actual invariant of tangles, you know, ordinary one-dimensional tangles in three-dimensional spaces, or drawn on the disk, or whatever, whichever way you want to view it. And I want to, hopefully you will completely understand the definition of the invariant and why it is invariant, and the proof that it is invariant. So that's my main goal, okay? But I need a few preliminaries, okay? So first of all, preliminaries from algebra. So FL of a list of generators is the freely algebra on these generators. So basically, should I say what it is? So basically, these are trees. So, you know, you write things, so you have three generators, X, Y, and Z, and you write all possible commutators, the commutator of Y and Z with X, all of these commutator again with X, and so on. So you write strange trees like this, and you mod out by the Jacobi relation so that the Jacobi relation is now holds. So it's a Lie algebra. So it's kind of better to view these things as trees rather than expressions, and it's clear, right, how an expression like this corresponds to a tree, right? You basically connect things and, this should have connected somewhere below, and you get a binary tree. And when you view it this way, the freely algebra becomes the collection of all binary trees with anti-symmetric vertices. So at each vertex, there is a left branch and a right branch, and there is the convention that if you swap the two, you get a minus sign. And modulo the Jacobi relation, which pictorially is this one. So this is, well, this is one side, well, this equality is the Jacobi relation, right? The bracket of one thing with the bracket of another two is equal to, well, some other combination of pairs of brackets, okay? And my lines are always directed, because they always go from the leaves towards the roots, okay? And all vertices are two in, one out, because the bracket has two inputs and one output. And over here, I only indicated the orientation in one place, because in each diagram, because that one place forces everything else, right? I mean, if there is an outgoing arrow here, then these two must be going, this one must be going to the right, this one must be going down, and everything else is forced. Okay? Okay. Well, the free associative algebra I already mentioned, and I want to mention that there is an obvious map from the free associative algebra on the freely algebra to the free associative algebra, which is defined by mapping the bracket to the commutator. which, by the way, in itself is in another interpretation of this IHS relation. So here's the picture. Here is an element of the free associative algebra on the Frehley algebra. So it's just a product of things ordered along this line at the bottom of trees. Each tree represents an element in the free Frehley algebra. And then if I want to convert it to an element of the free associative algebra, I just use this IHX relation once again, okay, I turn a bracket to a commutator. So wherever I see a tree with an internal vertex, I replace it by, well, the left side planted to the left of the right side minus the left side planted to the left of the right side minus the left side planted to the right of the left side. Okay? And when you do this replacement repeatedly, you get rid of all the internal vertices, and then you get just a comb, right, with numbers on the leaves. Okay? And that's an element of the free associative algebra. Is this clear? Okay. I actually don't care about that. It was just an example. What I care about is the vector space of cyclic words in some letters. What are cyclic words? So, well, instead of sort of combs with labeled tongues, it's wheels with labeled tongues. Okay? So basically these are pictorially, these are a thing like this. Okay, circles, cycles, in fact they should be oriented, so let's assume that my convention is to orient counterclockwise. And then each of these is a leaf, so it's labeled, it should be labeled by one of the generators. Here I suppress the labeling. Okay? And so alternatively, it's just the free associative algebra modulo the relations that if you have a word, you can take the first letter of that word and move it to bring it to be the last. Okay? And like the map from before, like this map, there is an obvious map going from cyclic words on the Frehley algebra to cyclic words. And it's exactly the same map. Okay, but here it is pictorially. So if you have a wheel of trees, so a cyclic word of elements in the Frehley algebra, you can, by iteratively getting rid of internal vertices like here, which is exactly the same rule as before, you can reduce it to a simple wheel. Okay, and if you want it even more schematically, then if you have a wheel of trees and a little prince, you can turn it into a simple-minded wheel. Okay? Are you with me? Is this okay? Okay. And the other preliminary from algebra that I really need is the definition of the exponential function. E to the x is equal to sine x to the d divided by d factorial. And the most important and highly non-trivial properties that the exponential function satisfies, e to the x plus y is e to the x times e to the y. Okay. I also need some preliminaries from knot theory. So, knots and tangles and other knotted objects have so-called Gauss diagram. What's a Gauss diagram? A Gauss diagram is what you get when you kind of pull the string of the knot to be a long line. So this is the parameter space of the knot here at the bottom. And each crossing on the original knot becomes a pair of points on the parameter line. So this crossing becomes this pair, these two points, this one and that one, and since they belong to the same crossing, I connect them by an arrow. Okay? Now, the convention is that the arrow goes from the overside of the crossing to the bottom, to the lower side of the crossing.
So here the arrow goes, well, from the beginning of the parametry, from the side closer to the beginning of the parametrization to the side which is later in the parametrization. So it's an arrow going to the right. And here I first go under. So this will be, the next arrow is a left going arrow. And furthermore, each arrow is also labeled by the sign of the crossing. So in this node, according to my convention, all signs are negative, so all arrows are labeled with a minus sign. Okay? You can actually reconstruct the node from the Gauss diagram, but it's irrelevant for what I will tell you next. Okay? Now, the same can be done for links or tangles. So here is a two-component tangle, so it has two components and they're tangled. And the parameter space is two intervals, and it has two crossings. Here are the crossings, and here I suppress the signs because my convention is that when the signs are positive, I suppress them. Okay, I hope this is positive. Yes, it is. Okay, are you with me? Okay. So here is the theorem. Yeah.
Can you just tell us what your convention is? Right hand rule or left hand rule?
A right hand rule.
Okay.
Why? Have I blundered? The one on the left is a blunder?
Yeah.
It is a blunder. Yeah, all of them are positive. Sorry.
That's fine.
Okay. 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 So here's the theorem. Omega, defined by the pictures below, is an invariant of tangles with any number of components. So the components are labeled by some elements of a finite set S. And it's an invariant with values in cyclic words in this alphabet S. Okay? So here's what you do. Well, you take the Gauss diagram of the knot, and you replace every arrow in it by an exponential sum of arrows, either with a positive exponential or negative exponential. So let me explain. Well, you take this arrow, the big one here, and you replace it by k parallel arrows going that way, okay? And you sum over all such all possible choices of k, running k goes from 0 to infinity, and you take plus 1 to the k because this is a positive arrow, divided by k factorial because we're talking about exponentials. And then you replace the second arrow, this one, with l parallel arrows. In the example, l is equal to 1, but l could be any integer. So you sum over all choices of l, minus 1 to the l, because this was a negative arrow, divided by l factorial, and likewise for the last arrow, which becomes m. Okay? So that's the first step. Second step, you take all the arrow tails. So here is an arrow tail. And you connect them, you just extend them so that they go all the way to the left of the picture. Well, the Gauss diagram was on an oriented skeleton, so to the left means towards the beginning of the skeleton. Okay? So I extend it to the left until it goes, well, out of the picture, well, to the edge. Okay? And then all the arrow heads I push down, I extend also, and I push them, and I let them end on one of the newly created lines, arcs that go underneath them, and I sum over all possibilities of ending them on this one, or that one, or that one. Okay? And this arrowhead, again, I will push down, and it will be a summation, and I will sum over all ways of ending it here, or ending it here, or ending it here, and so on. Now, this summation depends on the placement of the arrowhead. So, for example, for these arrowheads, there will be fewer summons, because there are fewer arcs flowing underneath them. Okay? Is so far is it clear?
So that's packing it as one sub? What is it?
Oh, so we have summation over K L and M of an expression like this, which in itself is a big sum. But it's a big sum of what? Okay? So after doing this summation, I forget the green line. The green line is there only to sort of remind you what to do. And of course, I forget the blue stuff, which is just, again, part of the construction material. And I am left with a picture in red. What is this picture in red? It's a trivalent graph, right? Ignore these crossings. These crossings are, well, those are not crossings. They're just sort of artifacts of the projection to the plane. So it's a trivalent graph. It has a vertex in every one, every arrowhead of the original diagram becomes a vertex. All of these vertices are of the two in, one out type, because they have one in coming from kind of minus infinity, one in coming from above, and an out going to the right. Okay? So we have a trivalent vertex, trivalent graph, which is a two in, one out graph. Okay? And I guess I forgot to say it, but I should have said it before, that in fact, all connected unitrivalent two in, one out graphs, unitrivalent means that they have trivalent vertices, but only also univalent vertices, which are these leaves at the end. Okay? So all connected unitrivalent two in, one out graphs so if you have a graph like that, what can you do? Right? So again, so suppose you have a trivalent graph with two in, one out. So you basically follow the directions indicated by the orientation of the edges. And since all ends are incoming, are leaves, okay, you must somehow come back to your own path. So you must have a cycle. And if you think about it, the graph must be a cycle with a number of trees converging into it. So basically, using the ingredients that I have, the only things I can grow are cycles of are closed cycles with trees converging into them. Okay? Basically, if I had something like that and I tried to add anything else, it would spoil the two in, one out rule. So that's the most I can get. So, graph theoretically, what you see here is a disjoint union of graphs, each of which is a cycle of trees. So interpret it as an element of the freely of cyclic words in the freely algebra, namely cyclic words, and you got an invariant with values in cyclic words. Okay? Now, in our case, we had one single skeleton component, so all leaves were the same, and you get an invariant in cyclic words that are labeled by only one label, so it's not really non-commutative. There is nothing for things. There isn't anything that can't commute. It's basically so a cyclic word in one letter is just the length of the word. There is no further information on it. Okay, but if you had several components, you would do exactly the same procedure on each component separately. Okay, except that the arrows, meaning the crossings, the arrows originally came from the crossings, may connect the different green lines. Okay, so basically I will pull the tails of each arrow towards the left. I will pull the tails here to the left, but then the arrows might connect the layers here. Okay. But now I have two different types of leaves. I have the leaves that came from the top component, and I will mark all of them A, and the leaves coming from the bottom component, and I will mark all of them B. And now the result is a wheel of trees, meaning just a wheel, with labels A and B. Now, I should have said, you can get disjoint union of such wheels. So omega is the restriction of this to the one component case. Okay? Omega is just the part of this sum that involves a single component. Okay? So is the definition clear?
Possible to show an example, but that's
these are examples.
But somehow, like, where it all gets, I guess by the time you're expanding it, it's hopeless.
It's a bit hard to. I don't know what to.
Yeah.
Okay. But basically, look at this picture and connect. Choose a way to connect the end to one of those lines below it, and you got a trivalent graph. A trivalent graph with sort of leaves, with labeled leaves. And therefore it's a wheel. Or a wheel of trees, which is therefore a wheel if I'm all out.
So are we six different ways, or whatever, nine different ways to connect up in this picture.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to sum over all of those, or we're supposed to just pick one?
No, sum over all of them. Okay. So the invariant is the connected part of sum over k and m of sum over all ways of
what
connected.
What does connected part mean?
What?
I'm still missing the point of what is connected part of those.
Okay, so this will be, in principle, a union of cycles. It will be a graph. I never said it's a connected graph.
I see.
Okay, in sort of these connections connecting these arrows to the arcs here kind of tend to make the graph more connected. But it may end up not being connected. It may be that all of the arrows are connected to the same arc here, and then the other arcs are
not. Oh, I see. You're saying there's a unique, there's a little combinatorial thing. There's a unique way of doing that, choosing the arrows so that it's connected.
No. You sum over all ways of doing it. If you get more than one connected component, you throw away the result. You just disregard it. So you pay attention only to the times when it is connected.
Okay.
Alternatively, you get an invariant with values in the symmetric algebra on cyclic words. And then you take the log within the symmetric algebra, and the result is connected things. So people familiar with quantum field theory will find it very, very familiar. It's like taking the log of the partition function gives you the partition function generated by connected Feynman diagrams. But anyway, it's enough to just think that you restrict your attention to the summons in which there is only one connected component. Okay? Good. So again, as I said, this is practically computable. So for the Borromean tangle, this is the result. The result should be a sum of cyclic words, meaning wheels, labeled by the colors of the component. Here it is, up to degree 5. So up to wheels of length 5. Okay? But I can, this is, 5. But I can compute it much higher. I mean, it's practically computable as a matter of just typing in the knot and hitting enter, and you get the answer in these terms. It really is practically computable.
Now also, it seems, if you think about it, it seems super exponential to compute. Of course it is exponential to compute, because if the target space has exponential size, no way the computation will not be exponential. But it's much less exponential than it seems. So I have techniques, which I'm not right now talking about, to reduce the computation to something manageable. So in fact, I can compute it to degree 8 or so for the Borromean tangle, and then in degree 8 you already have an invariant with values in a space of a, you know, pages of diagrams. Okay, I still have to tell you, I still have to tell you why this is an invariant, and I was going to go straight to the proof, and then I realized that I better add some information, but I ran out of space, so I had to put it in on top of the riddles that I made for you, for in case you're bored. So I'm sorry about the confusion appearance, okay? So don't look at the riddles, okay? So first of all, here is a rewrite of the IHX relation. So I have nothing to say. Combinatorially, having an arrow ending on an arrow that ends on a vertical line, so by IHX, this is the same as taking these two arrows and ending them in this order, minus ending them in that order. It's just, I've just deformed the picture to what will be more convenient in a minute. Okay? But even better, this arrow, the vertical arrow, could have been a multiplet of arrows. So it could have been 5 arrows parallel to each other, with the understanding that an arrow ending on 5 parallel arrows is really the sum of all ways of ending it on one of them. So a different statement of IHX is to say a picture like this, which really stands for the sum of two ways of ending this arrow, either here or here, is equal to a picture like this minus a picture like that. This is a sum, well, since there are only two terms here, this is a sum of 2 times 2, so a sum of 4 terms, this is a sum of 4 terms. Why is it true? So, well, you can basically by inspection. You write it, and it turns out that if these two arrows, right, we sum over all possible ways of ending them on one of the vertical strands. If they end on the same vertical strand, you get a term to cancel a term coming from here. If they end on different vertical strands, then the order does not matter, and they cancel a term from here. Said differently, by the way, this is the same reason why, algebraically it corresponds to the fact that the usual definition of a tensor product of representations of Lie algebras is a representation of Lie algebras. Basically, right, how does an element act on a tensor product? It's the sum of all ways of acting on one of the factors, and the verification that this is still a representation of Lie algebras is precisely this. Anyway, so now I need to show you invariants. So I need to show invariants under Rademeister 3. Well, you can check that in the language of Gauss diagrams, Rademeister 3 is this equality. So Rademeister 3 involves 3 strands, and 3 crossings, right? And really, the first strand goes over the second, then it goes over the third, then the second goes over the third, and this should be equal to the other way of doing it. Okay? So all I have to show you is that omega of the left-hand side is equal to omega of the right-hand side. So let's compute. What's omega of the left-hand side? Well, the rules are, you take every arrow of this kind, every Gauss diagram arrow, and replace it
by an exponential of arrows. So this e to the x really stands for an exponential of arrows. And these arrows have tails that get pulled to the bottom of the picture. So they get pulled towards the tails of the skeleton arrows. So, you know, this one has tails going down, this one has tails going down, and this one has tails going down. And the heads get connected to whatever they see in front of them in all possible ways. So the black lines here stand for whatever further arcs might have come from the further arc, from the further arrows that are above us in this picture. Okay? So so this arrowhead, you sum over all possible ways of ending it over on arcs that come from the top of the picture, from the rest of the picture, or the tails generated by this Z strand here. Okay? By the way, it's not, so these exponentials can be written here, can be turned into sort of something meaningful. So in other words, take these three exponentials, e to the x, e to the y, e to the z, multiply them, and you get a power, and expand them, and you get a power series in the variables x, y, and z. Okay? And then we really have a function from the space of power series to the space of pictures. Namely, if you look at the element in the power series ring, that looks like x to the k, y to the m, z to the l, it will be mapped to a picture like this, in which you have k of the x arrows, of arrows like this, of these arrows, m arrows like this, and l arrows like that. Okay? Anyway, so are you... Is this okay? It's probably not okay. Well, what can I do? Should I go over the details or tell you where it goes? I'll go over the details. Bear with me, I'll do it quickly. Basically, the X arrows can end either here or here. So each X arrows comes from in two brands. Sort of the X1 type that ends here and the X2 type that ends here. So you can think of X as being X1 plus X2, and then replace e to the X by e to the X1 plus e to plus X2, and then use the property of exponentiation, which is e to the X plus Y is e to the X e to the Y. And then the error, and replace this by a picture like this, where the X2 arrows end here, and the X1 arrows end here, but since there is nothing between here and the top, I can slide them to the top. So this picture is equal to that one, and the interpretation of that one is exactly as before. Namely, you expand each of these into a power series, and then, you know, if you get x2 to the power 5, it means that this arrow really stands for 5 parallel arrows that do the same thing. Okay? Now, look at the x2 arrows, and they end on a red strand that heads into a bigger kind of arc. This is exactly the picture that was shown here. This is exactly this picture. So I replace the left-hand side by the right-hand side. Okay? And so an X2 arrow, each X2 arrow becomes either an arrow that ends above the Z or an arrow that ends below the Z. Okay? So really, you can replace x2 by x3 plus minus x4. Sorry, there was a minus sign there. And e to the x2 becomes e to the x3 times e to the minus x4. So this picture is equal to that picture. But in this picture, the e to the y cancels the e to the minus x4, because in fact, y and x4 are the same kind of arrows. They do exactly the same thing. They start here, and they end in the same place. So these two cancel, and you're left with x1, x3, and z arranged in this way, which is exactly the other side of the Rademacher 3 move. OK, I know you didn't follow me. OK, but at least you should have followed the fact that there is nothing here except completely silly combinatorics and the property of the exponential function. E to the x plus y is equal to e to the x e to the y. So I should thank Esther sitting over there for forcing me to go through this argument myself. OK. And so therefore, maybe you should not thank her. OK, what do I have to tell you about this invariant? OK? OK, actually, this is the second part of an invariant with values in trees and wheels. I told you about the wheels part, but there is a complementary trees part to this invariant. I think I want to skip the definition. It's in a similar spirit, but not quite the same. And the tree part, one reason to skip it is because it's just a repackaging of the Milner mu invariants. It contains nothing new to people who know the Milner mu invariants. The wheels part is new. Okay, next. On ordinary tangles, this entire invariant is equivalent to the trees and wheels part of the Koncievich integral, if you know what it is. So in some sense, it's not new either. But the difference with the from the Koncievich integral is that it's completely computable. And in fact, the Koncievich integral for tangles depends on a parenthetization of the ends of the tangles. So it's somehow not a canonical object. And this is a canonical object. So for any choice of parenthetizations, the Koncievich integral is equivalent to this. But with different equivalences for different choices, and that's a canonical choice of the Wheels part of the Koncievich integral, which does not depend on a parenthetization. Next, so if you restrict your attention to long knots, or round knots, which is the same. I mean, it's an invariant of tangles, but if you restrict your attention to tangles with one component, these are just long knots. So you get an invariant of long knots with values in cyclic words in one letter, but that's just the power series ring. So you get what you get is a reparametrization of the Alexander polynomial. So in some sense, the rest of the invariant, so the invariant on tangles which are not knots with more than one component, is some sort of a non-commutative extension of the Alexander polynomial. To justify it, let me say that if you abelianize this invariant for tangles, so you look at the tangle case and declare that all the letters actually commute with each other, then what you get contains the multivariable Alexander polynomial. So it really is a generalization of the Alexander polynomial. Further, less interesting facts. So omega vanishes on braids. So the tree part does not vanish on braids, but the wheels part completely vanishes on braids. Next, so it is probably related in one way or another to some article by Farber that's in the references, but I don't want to say anything about it. Maybe I would not say the thing about categorification. But I do want to say that it extends to V and descends to W. So what are V and W? So, okay. First of all, the way I defined the invariant, it was really an invariant of Gauss diagrams.
okay? And nothing in the way I presented it required that those Gauss diagrams be planar, be representable by planar knots. And in fact, the invariant is really an invariant of Gauss diagrams modulo modulo this relation, okay, and the relations corresponding to Rademeister 2, regardless of whether these Gauss diagrams came or did not come from knots. So it is an invariant of what is called virtual knots, or more precisely, virtual tangles. So that's the extends to V. It's trivially, it's in fact defined on virtual knots or virtual tangles. But then when you look at it, you can see very quickly that it satisfies this relation. So if you have two arrows in a Gauss diagram that correspond to two adjacent overcrossings, you can commute the two overcrossings one over the other. So this relation does not make sense for ordinary knots, but it completely makes sense in at the level of Gauss diagrams, and it's the so-called overcrossings commute relation of virtual knot theory. So our invariant satisfies this relation. Also, it satisfies the further relation that if you have an arrowhead near the top of a strand, so basically if the last crossing on a strand is an undercrossing, so it's under something else, then you can drop that crossing. That crossing does not participate in the invariant, does not change the value of the invariant. So the invariant of this is equal to the invariant of that. Okay? And if you wanted a kind of Rademeister picture for this, the picture is that the somehow correct domain of the invariant omega, this I added later so it's not on the handout, so the correct domain of the invariant omega is tangles which have ends over which you can slide things, so modulo the relation that you can slide things over the top ends. Now, it turns out that there is no loss in connecting the bottom ends to a single point. So you can may as well connect all the bottom ends to a single point. And otherwise, you have crossings and virtual crossings. And you mod out by the usual Rademeister moves and virtual Rademeister moves, and the additional overcrossings commute relation, which is written here. So really, the somehow true domain space of this invariant is pictures like this, modulo the usual relations and two more. Such pictures, well, I think I'll skip the universal finite type. I'll skip the other good properties, but only tell you that such pictures are combinatorial representations of a certain type of two knots in R4. But the combinatorial but it's only a certain type of two knots in R4, and the combinatorial representation is not perfect. So I think I'm both losing your patience and the time is ending. So so very, very briefly, let me tell you that the two knots that are involved are so-called simple two knots, and only simple two knots, but on the other hand, all simple two knots. So a simple two knot is a knot which may have, which that has a projection to R3, it's a knot in R4, but it has a projection to R3 in which there are only lines of double points, really circles of double points. But no triple points or, what are they called? Branch points? Yeah. So, you know, here are some standard pictures of two knots, which are simple two knots. So this one and that one, and I will not tell you more about them. I will tell you, though, that there is a combinatorial calculus for simple two knots. So
And the combinatorial calculus involves pictures that look more or less like the usual pictures of ordinary knots. So here is a crossing, but the crossing really corresponds to some two knots. Here is a two knot in R4, and you know, I could click here and you would see it rotating, but I think I'd rather move on. So basically there is some combinatorial calculus for two knots in, for simple two knots in R4, in which the ordinary crossing correspond to a certain way of two tubes to interact. The virtual crossings correspond to a certain other way for two tubes to interact. And the dot at the end of strands correspond to capping a tube. So at the end, a picture like was shown here becomes a tube starting at infinity and getting capped, so it's exactly a balloon. Okay? So under this calculus, this picture really corresponds to a knotted balloon.
Can you show us an animation?
No. I should move on. But I should say, okay.
You have a break right after, so you can take extra time and show us the animation if you want.
No. I'd rather.
Then we'll make you.
I mean, you know, maybe. Possibly my feeling is wrong. I mean, my feeling is that you want me out of here. Okay. Are you sure? But you know what? Let me first sort of finish the kind of discussion and then possibly show some pictures. Okay? So, okay, there are two kind of things that are wrong with this story, at least. First of all, I should say, the part about tangles is completely correct, completely rigorous, there is nothing wrong with it, and it really does represent a non-commutative generalization of the Alexander polynomial, multivariable Alexander polynomial, which for all I know was not known before. Maybe people here will correct me. The defects are with the lifting to two knots. So one defect is that this combinatorial calculus for two knots, here it is, maps into two knots, and in fact is known to map onto simple two knots, so those two knots of the kind that I've mentioned. So it's surjective, but it's not known if we know all the relations. Okay, it's not known if these are all the relations. So in other words, the invariant that I've defined is a good invariant of ordinary tangles and is an invariant of combinatorial two tangles, or W knots if you want, but I don't know if it is a genuine invariant of two knots or simple two knots or whatever.
So is the point somehow that you might have, when if you look this full set of relations for, say, moves on two knots, but you had two simple two knots might be related by something that passes through something that's not simple?
That's exactly the difficulty. So, you know, if I want to summarize it into a big open problem, so the big open problem is to find a simple description of simple two knots. How catchy can you get? Okay, so simple two knots are the two knots that have a projection to R3 with only double points, so no triple points and no branches. And it's not called branch, what is it called?
Cusp,
whatever. Okay, so anyway, none of these, only these. And what I mean by a simple description is a Rademeister theory. And in fact, there is a conjectured Rademeister theory. We just don't know if it's right. Okay? Okay, and then the other big question is, does this story extend to arbitrary two knots? Not necessarily simple two knots. And again, there are indications that it does. Namely, there is some specific quantum field theory, the BF quantum field theory, and again, I don't think I want to go through the details, but it was written by, it was discussed by, I don't know who wrote it first, but it was analyzed by many people, but the analysis closest to what we need is by Cattaneo and Rossi. And these gentlemen, along with Watanabe, have shown how to write Feynman diagrams for this quantum field theory. And the Feynman diagrams are certain, well, multiple integrals or give invariants that are written in terms of multiple integrals that are parameterized by exactly the same kind of diagrams as the diagrams that I mentioned before, modulo the exact same relations. And they are defined, they're completely, those definitions are completely geometric. They don't even see the projection to R3. So, a priori, it seems that it should make sense for arbitrary two knots with no difficulty at all. Okay? So it seems that everything should extend to arbitrary two knots. Except, as always with quantum field theory, there are difficulties. And again, I could tell you more about the difficulties, but I think I've already said too much. Okay? So maybe I'll go back to where Liam interrupted me and try to tell you more about the combinatorial calculus. Okay? But I only have 4 minutes. So I think I'd rather do it with my usual toys rather than the videos. Sorry. So basically, if you think of a two knot in R4, you can slice R4 at different values of time, and you see a one knot in R3. So a two knot in R4 is a movie of one knot in R3, okay? In which there occasionally are some catastrophes. So basically, occasionally you go through a creation or annihilation or a saddle, okay? But let's ignore these times and talk only about flying rings in R3, okay? So this picture over here represents a pair of rings that fly in R3, and one passes through the other. So the convention is so the two rings exchange places by one of them flying through the other. Okay? And the convention is that the lower strand is the one that flies through, that goes through the upper one. So here is sort of the movie representation. So the lower one is the one which starts on the right at the bottom, and it's sort of the smaller one, it passes through the big one and comes out on the other side. Okay? The virtual crossing corresponds to two rings that interchange their location externally. Now, in ordinary braid theory, there is a difference between exchanging locations externally this way or that way. But in fact, we're one dimension up, so you can interpolate between exchanging locations this way and that way by going through exchanging location that way. So in fact, all external ways of interchanging location are equivalent to each other. So therefore, I don't even need to specify which one is the sort of over or under or left or right. I just indicate it as two strands which exchange location. Okay? So a a braid-like picture made out of these two types of crossings corresponds to a braiding of rings flying around in R3, occasionally switching, occasionally flying through each other or interchanging positions externally. Okay? And then a cap just represents a ring flying into nothingness. So a ring shrinking until it becomes nothing, and that's just a cap, topologically. Okay? And then it's just a matter of what do they do to the remote? I don't know. But then it's just a matter of testing that the relations written here are all satisfied. So the Rademeister 2 move written over here is just the fact that if you fly and then fly back, it's homotopic to doing nothing. So fly, exchange locations by flying the other way, it's homotopic to doing nothing. The Rademeister, the virtual Rademeister 2 corresponds to the fact that if you externally switch locations and then switch locations back, you've done nothing. The Rademeister 3 corresponds to the fact that if you have sort of rings of three sizes and they exchange they exchange order by, well, I don't know how to do it with the number of hands that I have, but essentially by all of them flying through the others, then it's equivalent to doing nothing. Sorry, then it's equivalent to doing it in the opposite order. Well, if I had more hands, I'd show you. Okay? And the interesting facts are the overcrossings commute relation, which again, in ordinary log theory, this has no analog. This is the interesting bit. So basically, it involves two small rings, right? These are small because they're under the big one. So it involves two small rings flying through a big ring, okay? In two different ways. And the picture is, sorry, I have to make this one small. Oops, it wants to pop up back out. Anyway, so I have two small rings. Maybe I need a volunteer. Liam, you made me do it, so you do the volunteer. So just hold it straight. So basically, two small rings flying through this one, they can either interchange their location first and then fly through, or fly through and then exchange locations. And the and these are exactly the two, and the two are of course homotopic to each other, because they could have interchanged locations right in the middle. And that's this relation. But notice that the opposite of this relation, you're not off the hook yet, does not hold. In other words, if you have two big rings, you know what, you are off the hook, then a small ring can fly through this and then that, okay? So this is one picture. And it's not the same as, first of all, this interchange location, and then this one flies through. Because, well, topologically, I could have done it, I could have held both of them in place and have this one go through this one first and then that one, or go through this one first and then that one. And the two are obviously not the same. Okay, so there is some broken symmetry between the oversides and the undersides. And then basically any planar picture you can write with these modulo these relations represents a simple two knot in R4. And it's an open problem whether these are all the relations. Okay. Blame me.
Okay, other questions for Gore?
So in this simple two-knot theory, it's a simple knot equivalent theory, simple knot
Well, a knot is always simple. A two knot is always sort of,
okay.
Simplicity is a property of a knot type. It's, there exists a projection so that there are only double points in that projection.
Right.
Okay. So the question is really, suppose we have even this is not precise, but more or less, if you have two projections, so you have, you know, two projections of a simple, or two, well, if you have an isotopy of simple two knots, the isotopy necessarily, occasionally, will have a non-simple projection. I mean, even with these pictures, there will be times, so when I exactly go through, the projection will be non-simple. But what you want is to find a set of moves between simple projections such that two simple projections are isotopic or represents isotopic knots if you can move within using only this collection of moves. Okay. So the
language here is actually a bit different, but these are the proposed moves.
Other questions? That's it. Thank you very much.